Coming up, what should be done about ISIS and refugees? Also, the words of Ta-Nehisi Coates, the winner announced this week of the 2015 National Book Award for Nonfiction. And Fred DeSam Lazaro on the amazing turnaround of Medellin in Colombia, once best known for drugs and murder.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week of anger, grieving, fear, and worldwide condemnation of the deadly terrorist attacks in Paris and elsewhere, with many responses from religious groups. Our managing editor, Kim Lawton, reports.
All week long, people of faith have been offering special prayers for peace, healing, and an end to terrorism. ISIS claimed the attacks fulfilled directives in the Quran, but numerous Muslim leaders across the globe strongly denounced the violence, calling it despicable and a perversion of Islam. Pope Francis said using the name of God to justify such violence is blasphemy. Here in the U.S., religious groups were heavily involved in the political debate over whether the U.S. should stop admitting Syrian and Iraqi refugees because of security concerns. Some politicians proposed that America either stop taking in Syrians altogether or just admit Christian refugees. During a visit to Turkey, President Obama vigorously opposed such calls.
That's shameful. That's not American. It's not who we are. We don't have religious tests to our compassion.
Well, of course, you know, we don't apply religious tests, but we should apply ideological tests. And I would be very reticent to bring in people who are ideologically opposed to the ideal of America.
A wide range of faith groups urged political leaders not to impose any new limits on refugees. A statement from the National Association of Evangelicals said, quote, "Let's not punish the victims of ISIS for the sins of ISIS." Since 2011, the U.S. has helped resettle about 2,000 of the millions who have fled the conflict in Syria. The U.S. Catholic bishops said the church believes it has a moral obligation to help people who are suffering and persecuted.
Our efforts, though, are going to be to reach out to people and to serve them. And my hope would be that the church would continue to be able, within the law, to accept and help families as we've done in the past.
Meanwhile, Islamic minorities in many countries report suffering a backlash since the Paris attacks. Muslims in France and Britain say they're facing increasing hostility. American Muslims say they, too, have seen a sharp rise in threats and vandalism at mosques and Islamic centers. There have been calls for increased scrutiny and suggestions that some mosques be closed. Many interfaith leaders are expressing solidarity with U.S. Muslims and urging that all Muslims not be held responsible for the actions of a few.
Joining me now to discuss all of this are Kim Lawton, Manal Omar, Associate Vice President of the Center for Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Rabbi Jack Moline, Executive Director of the Interfaith Alliance. Welcome to you all. Manal, let me begin with you. Assuming that ISIS represents only a small minority of all Muslims, is there any such thing as a consensus among all Muslims about what should be done about ISIS to defeat it?
Well, let's just confirm as a fact that it does represent all a very minority. It's less than 30,000, and when you're talking about 1.5 billion, it's absolutely minimal. But what's happened is that the Muslims have recognized across the globe that they do need to step forward, and the consensus is to really show that it is not part of Islam. It's, you know, the messaging is completely fabricated, and the type of extremism just has no place within an Islamic framework.
Mm-hmm. Jack, do you sense any kind of a common ground among
I've yet to meet any Muslim in this country who has any sympathy for ISIS at all. And I think that's probably the best indication that, that Manal is absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm. Within that, then, what is the role of the religious community, whether we're talking about Muslims or interfaith groups? What is the role to counter the messages that, that are just out there so vividly right now?
I think the interfaith community is really in the spotlight right now. All the work that has been done for decades has kind of culminated to this point. Can they stand together to really contradict ISIS? ISIS is trying to manifest the clash of civilization of Islam against the West. And what we need to show is this is you against the world.
Mm-hmm. I'm very impressed that in these days when there are people calling for all sorts of restrictions as to who can come to this country, that I haven't heard a single religious voice speak up and say that that's a good idea. People I never find myself in coalition with are inviting me to stand with them and say there should be no religious test for our compassion toward refugees.
And what does that say? I mean, what does that say to you?
Well, it says to me that the people who are attempting to exploit the fear that comes along with any terror act anywhere in the world are barking up the wrong tree. People are indeed afraid, but they're not hearing the solution in responding in kind.
Manal, what's it like for you personally these days when there is so much hostility to all Muslims?
It's very concerning. I mean, what frightens me the most is that a lot of the training that I've taken for hostile environments like Kabul or Baghdad or Benghazi is now, I'm using it here in Washington, D.C. I'm afraid to travel in the streets. There's a lot of tension in metros. But I would emphasize that along with the bad is a lot of good. I mean, the interfaith alliances that have reached out to me, people I've worked with, particularly in women's rights groups, have reached out asking, do I need help? Do I need someone to go grocery shopping with me? So as much as the negative, there's been a lot of positive, and I think that I want to highlight that side more and more.
Jack, what are you recommending to all those in the Interfaith Alliance and to everybody else about what to do about all the speech that's going on now, free speech, that is just terribly destructive?
The most important thing is to reach out to friends and neighbors and to reassure them that we're all Americans and we're all in this together. The values that were soberly considered as we built this country and progressed through our history are the values we can rely on now, and we shouldn't abandon them simply because there have been some bad actors, particularly thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing enough of support for that point of view at the grassroots? I mean, certainly we're hearing from leaders saying, you know, interfaith leaders saying we shouldn't scapegoat all Muslims for the acts of a few. We're hearing these statements, but yet you're seeing in local communities tension and vandalism and threats. I mean, it's coming from somewhere. You know, how do you address that?
So it's a dilemma because a lot of the polling shows that there is indeed a negative attitude toward Muslims in this country that is being generated by their reaction to these terrorist events in Europe and in the Middle East. On the other hand, the responsibility, I think, of religious leaders who still hold a tremendous amount of influence in America is not to be Pollyannas about it, not to try to give people false hope, but to remind them of the values and to remind them of the realities. As Manal said, 30,000 people out of a billion and a quarter is a drop in the bucket. And while I understand that if that drop is in your bucket, it's of concern, the drop is not in our bucket, and that's a very important thing to remember.
To what extent is this, the fear and some of the rhetoric that we're hearing, to what extent is that playing into ISIS's hands? I mean, is this something they really want to see? Is this something they're trying to see?
Absolutely, and I think it's a really important question because that is their strategy. Is, you know, they're a terrorist organization. They want us to live in terror. And most importantly, they're trying to attack what, you know, is universal human rights, the ideals that America and the West have been promoting. And so the best way to do that is to get people to actually start questioning it in the name of security. And that is their strategy. The number one target is Muslims. And so they're trying to tell Muslims around the world there's no place for you in the world except in our area, which is a really frightening message.
That's an extraordinarily important point because if ISIS is allowed to define the terms of this engagement, then they've pretty much won the battle. We have to understand them and meet them where they're coming from, but not capitulate, not really surrender to the terror that they're trying to spread, because that's the victory they're looking for.
Manal, what are you hearing coming to you from Muslims all around the United States?
We're hearing a lot of concern over security. I work more in the international field, but a lot of the American Muslim organizations have issued warnings and, you know, heightened alerts, and, you know, particularly around the masjid. I was particularly impressed by a mosque in Johnstown that did an open house in response, saying, if you're scared of us, come visit us. And a friend of mine who is in Pennsylvania reached out and told me, you know, do you think this is a good idea? And it was a huge success. And I would encourage more mosques and more Muslims to do that as well.
Yeah, our time is up. I'm sorry. Many thanks to Manal Omar of the U.S. Institute of Peace and to Rabbi Jack Moline of the Interfaith Alliance.
Thanks, Bob.
Good to talk to both
of
you.
Thank you.
In other news, Rome has beefed up security in the wake of the Paris attacks. Officials raised the security level to the highest allowed without a direct attack on the country. The Italian government has placed 700 extra soldiers in public spaces, including St. Peter's Square, where Pope Francis gives his weekly address. Tourists visiting Vatican City encountered heightened security checks. On Wednesday, there was extra security around Francis's Popemobile. Still, Francis emphasized that despite increased fears, the doors of Catholic churches around the world must remain open. Security is also a concern as Francis prepares to visit Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic next week. Despite more than 11,000 UN troops and police in the Central African Republic, violence between Christians and Muslims continues in the capital city of Bangui and elsewhere. As of now, Francis is scheduled to visit a mosque in one of Bangui's most dangerous districts. The former French colony descended into interreligious violence 2.5 years ago. This week, Francis visited a Lutheran church in Rome. And in what came as a surprise to some, he suggested that Lutherans married to Catholics should decide for themselves whether to take communion in the Catholic Church. Francis emphasized that faithful Lutherans must listen to what God is telling them to do in their situation. The Catholic Church currently prohibits non-Catholics from participating in communion. Francis also said Christian denominations must forgive one another for historic persecutions. U.S. Catholic bishops from around the country met in Baltimore and released a revised election year guide. It stresses a moral imperative to evaluate candidates based on their positions on gay marriage and abortion. Although the guide addresses a wide range of issues, some bishops expressed disappointment that the document called Faithful Citizenship failed to follow in the steps of Pope Francis by giving greater emphasis to issues such as the environment and poverty. The bishops have released a voting guide before every presidential election for almost 40 years. A new survey by the Public Religion Research Institute indicates Americans of various faiths are anxious about Islam and also about racial tensions. According to the poll, a majority of Americans, 56%, believe the values of Islam are at odds with American values. And the number of Americans who say racial tensions are a major concern in their community has more than doubled since 2012 to 35% now. The survey was conducted before the Paris attacks. Now, the words of Ta-Nehisi Coates, this week named the 2015 winner of the National Book Award for Nonfiction. We talked with him recently at Howard University in Washington, where he spoke about his book, Between the World and Me, and about what he calls the constant deep-seated fear among African Americans for themselves, their bodies, and their children.
My earliest memories are of black men in jail, of being physically restrained. So I was aware of, like, I'm talking like 4 years old, I guess, is when the point when you become like maybe somewhat conscious of what's happening in the world around you, 3-4 years old. These are my earliest memories. And so this fear, this deep-seated fear of bodily harm never leaves. In fact, it marks African-American life and may be the premier marker, you know, of the black experience under white supremacy in this country, perhaps everywhere. I'm seeing people that want to live free. You know, I'm seeing people that want to live independent of that fear. I'm saying people who have been boxed in by American policy to live within that fear. And I see people who want to be free. One of the arguments of the book is that you are your body. The people who do damage to our bodies do, in fact, do damage to our minds and our souls. And the act of liberation is ultimately always physical. Even reading is a physical act. It's a physical act. There were incredible black folks here at Howard. I had never imagined the black world to be that large. There was really just a sense of ancestry. You know, I'm not a particularly spiritual person, but one would walk across the yard, you could feel like ghosts walking behind you, right? There was just a great diversity of people, you know, of opinion, and all of them, you know, united under this one thing, you know, under this idea of being black. I sat for a good afternoon and read James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. This is like the origin. This is like, you know, the beginning very much for me right here. So this place we're sitting in is very, very powerful, very, very important to me. I didn't come out of the church. I don't have an intuitive understanding of what religion gives to people. I just don't. You know what I mean? I didn't really grow up in a Christian household. You know, I grew up in a household where folks had respect for religion, but it was not a huge, huge force in my life. And so I'm very distanced from that. I think, you know, for both good and ill, it probably marks my writing. I don't know where the arc of the moral arc of the universe bends. I don't see it necessarily bending, you know, towards a more just world. Sometimes the world is more just. Sometimes it's not. Between the world and me is, I hope a work of art. You know, it's a you know, a riff on, you know, how we have to talk to our children. And I hope it serves to, you know, confirm and validate the experiences of black folks, you know, who are out there and who are going through this every day.
We have a Fred DeSam Lazaro story today about the amazing turnaround of the city of Medellin in Colombia. Once it was best known for drugs and murder, but not now. With stunning new buildings, good leadership, a helpful church, and even an electric utility that gives back its profits, Medellin has come a long way.
Colombia's long-running civil war has uprooted hundreds of thousands of rural citizens who've crowded into cities. In Medellin, perhaps a fifth of the 2.4 million inhabitants are displaced people like Cecilia Marin.
We came to Medellin in 1996. The guerrillas had taken over one of our homes and killed a person right in front of our house. We were tired of witnessing all this violence.
Not that Medellin offered much safe haven. The conflict with leftist FARC guerrillas was in the city, too. There also were right-wing, so-called self-defense militias, set up by rich landowners and often allied with the government.
Once we had the narco-trafficking, things became even more complicated. You had narco-violence, political violence, and also that of the self-defense forces.
Medellin became known as the cocaine capital and the murder capital of the world, home of the notorious drug lord Pablo Escobar, who was killed by police in 1993. Much of the drug trade has since shifted to Central America, and here in Medellin, Father Gomez says things have calmed down considerably.
The city has undergone a transformation. It's been a positive one. Things are thought out now. How do we make streets? How do we make houses? Infrastructure? How do we improve mobility, health, education? It's had an integrative approach. People got tired of fighting.
Medellin has seen a dramatic drop in violence, the murder rate down from about 380 per 100,000 people to about 50. Experts credit a general calming trend across Colombia in recent years. There's even a peace process mediated by Cuba between the government and the leftist FARC guerrillas. Also, they credit the efforts of new political leadership to bring people together in the city, says Alejandro Echeverry.
When we look at the narco-trafficking years of Pablo Escobar, people did not trust each other. They built barriers around themselves and they put walls up. So public space in the city takes on a far greater significance than anywhere else because people didn't look each other in the eye when they walked down the street.
Echeverry is an architect. He was part of the administration a decade ago that set out to create safe public spaces with a focus on poorer sections. We spoke in front of the Exploratorium he designed, a science museum that's one of several distinctive new buildings.
This project right here is part of a broader narrative of social urbanism that the city started in 2003 and 2004. This place is symbolic because it connects the north of the city, which has a lot of poor neighborhoods and has traditionally been stigmatized, with the south. It's not just the Exploratorium, it's also the Botanical Gardens and the Metro.
The Metro is perhaps the most extraordinary of all the building projects here, with a system of escalators and gondolas you typically see at ski resorts. Here they reach into the barrios. These neighborhoods cling to the mountains that surround the city, an almost vertical hike that was a barrier that excluded the poor, Echeverry says.
All of these policies are geared towards trying to decrease inequality and include the poor and marginalized sectors who today can now access transportation and other services.
Along the new transit routes are community centers, libraries where there's everything from computer and internet stations to loan programs for would-be entrepreneurs, like Fernando Posada. Today, Posada's expanding from 2 to 4 employees. His cookies and waffle chips look like professional products, he proudly says, and they are selling well.
Since I got training, I've been able to professionalize and mechanize our production to meet all the labeling requirements so that we can sell in more stores.
The money for all this comes from an unlikely source for a city.
One of the biggest drivers of Medellin's transformation is a company headquartered here called EPM. It's one of Latin America's most profitable electric utilities. This company is wholly owned by the city, but it's run independently and privately. It pays taxes to the city, but it also sends its profits to the city. And last year, those amounted to nearly $600 million.
EPM has expanded into 6 Latin American countries and seen record profits in recent years. It has fueled construction that's won Medellin international awards, says urban affairs scholar Catalina Ortiz. But that's due to good public relations as well, she adds, and it's not the whole story.
Don't be fooled by the great marketing that has been done. Scratch a little bit more, and you are going to find several things that usually are not really unveiled.
Not unveiled, she says, is a huge housing challenge.
Housing to rehouse the households that are located in risky areas, or try to break the segregation pattern and try to have more mixed income housing, for instance.
The poor are pushed ever higher up the mountainside, she says, where they often endure poor construction and inadequate basic services like water.
The refrigerator will go here and the stove will go here.
Medellin's Catholic Archdiocese tries to assist displaced people like Cecilia Marin. She shares this tiny home with her husband, daughter, and 2 grandchildren. The church's social services arm offers the help of building engineers and generally advocates for better services and even helps families dealing with domestic violence. Cecilia Marin says she feels fully resettled now.
I believe without my faith, I wouldn't have gotten here. Why would I want to return to my village? Life is the most important thing, and I value my life.
The fact that she prefers Medellin is testament to the city's progress. But like many experts, architect Echeverry says there's still a ways to go. Crime, though lower, is still high. Corruption remains a problem, as does high unemployment in a city whose historic industries, like textiles, have gone away.
There still remains a profound level of inequality here, and a lot of economic policies that exclude the poor, a lot of it due to globalization. I'm also concerned about politics. Things are very fragile and could change very quickly. But I'm optimistic because Medellin does have this spirit of social commitment and trust.
He's proudest, he says, that Medellin has used public architecture to start down the path of repairing its cocaine-sullied reputation. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSame Lazaro in Medellin, Colombia.
Finally, with Thanksgiving Day next Thursday, Lifeway Research in Tennessee has taken a poll asking a national sample, what's the most important part of the holiday? The answer was not watching football or getting a jump on Christmas shopping or even the feast, welcoming a good harvest. Having time with family and friends was the number two choice with 39%. Number one, for just over half the country, was being thankful to God for my blessings. Happy Thanksgiving. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, music from the Kennedy Center in Washington, the spiritual Ride On King Jesus, is part of a new series focusing on racial reconciliation and social justice.
Ride on!
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.